It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
What happens in any disease, any infectious disease, is depending on how the course of that pathogen in an individual's body. What happens in a pandemic is the course of that pathogen through the entire society.
Hello, and welcome to Why Is This Happening with me, your host, Chris Hayes. Hopefully my voice sounds better now than it did last week. We're slowly adjusting to the new reality. I'm podcasting in a closet like you do. Hopefully you get a nice kind of close and intimate sound, not roomy echo. My faithful audio engineer and assistant and co-pilot in all things, Kate Shaw, has been helping me. We've got a good microphone set up here, so hopefully all is good. And, you know, we took your feedback last week about whether you were chomping at the bit for more coronavirus content or whether you wanted to escape from coronavirus content. And we got a mixed bag. Some people saying, like, I want to get away from it. Some people saying, yes, I want more, but not just the stuff you do in the news. So today we have something that I think sort of perfectly fits in the middle of those two places. You have probably heard a lot in the last few weeks, last month, about the great flu pandemic of 1918. In fact, I would be willing to bet, unless you're an epidemiologist or a historian of this particular period, the odds are very high that you have heard more in the last few weeks about the great flu pandemic of 1918 than you had ever heard in your entire life before. And so I had known about the great flu pandemic in 1918 before this moment. I'd always sort of been interested in it. In fact, it was adjacent to a book project that I had sort of thought of doing at a certain point and may pursue in the future. But when this started last February, when it started gathering steam, I wanted to read a book about it. And so I turned to Twitter, as I often do, and I said, what's the best chronicle of the great flu pandemic of 1918? And the number one vote in that was a book called The Great Influenza, which was published in 2004 by John Barry. And I read it and they were right. It's fantastic. It's an incredible piece of work. It's a fascinating look at all different sort of contours of it. It is striking how chillingly prescient it is today. And in fact, John Barry in March 17th wrote a piece for the New York Times on the op-ed page called The Single Most Important Lesson from the 1918 Influenza. So if you want to understand basically the last great pandemic, what are the lessons we can learn from 102 years ago as we fight this? I thought there was no one better to talk to than John Barry. So, John, how did you first get interested in the great flu pandemic of 1918?
Well, oddly enough, I planned to write a book about the home front in World War I, culminating in 1919. Which I think is one of the most interesting years in American history. But the way I live on in a book advance, and that would have taken me 7 years or so, I didn't think I'd get a big enough advance. I was interested in influenza. It almost became a scientist, a medical researcher, and thought I could subsidize the larger book by researching that book, which I thought I could complete in an easy 2 years, no worse than 2.5, but it took me 7 years.
So that's interesting. So you went into it thinking, I'm gonna break this into small pieces, and the flu pandemic, that'll be a smaller thing than the big home front project, right? But it ended up ballooning to the exact same size.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's fascinating because one of the things that I'm discovering right now, and this shows up in the book as well, is that a pandemic is a moment when every single field of human knowledge comes together, where every single form of human behavior and institutional order come together. So everything from biology to economics to statistics to mathematical models to government structure, all of this gets, you know, crushed together in how you end up dealing with the pandemic. And that's clear in your book.
Well, I mean, you're exactly right. It puts pressure on every element of human society. they all have to respond one way or another.
The book starts with a fascinating history and disquisition on American medical history that I knew nothing about. So maybe we can start there, which is that basically in the late 19th century, 30, 40 years before the flu, what was the state of American medicine?
Well, it was the worst in the Western world. If you could pay your fees, you could get into medical school. Harvard, you only needed to pass 5 out of 9 courses to get a medical degree. In most medical schools, you never saw a patient. Every course was a lecture. Very few had schools had microscopes. This is we're talking about deep into the 19th century, after Pasteur, while in Germany, Koch, Robert Koch is already establishing great things. So it was extraordinarily backward.
The sense I got from your book, and this economic model is fascinating, is that these faculties were essentially, right, the medical faculties were paying themselves through fees and had no incentive for standards. They just wanted as many customers to come through
exactly
as possible.
Right. If you student fees were faculty salaries, so they were not going to reject you. If you could, make your way to the bank, you were in. Reform initially started after a recent Harvard graduate failed a course on pharmacology. He prescribed 7 or 8 patients in a row a fatal dose of morphine. And then Harvard at least started to get a little better. But the real reform came with the founding of Johns Hopkins Medical School and a brilliant pathologist, impresario type, William Welsh, who's might very well be the most important figure in the history of American science, not just American medicine. He was the president of every scientific society practically in the United States that he had any tangential involvement in, including the National Academy of Sciences. And Hopkins was modeled after the German universities. Very rigorous, very difficult to get accepted, all science-based, lab-based, really examine patients and closely. And that model, attracted, most of the people who wanted to become doctors were highly motivated, and many of them ended up going to Europe to get real training because the training in the United States was so poor. But they all wanted to go to Hopkins, and Harvard had to compete, and University of Pennsylvania competed, and Hopkins sort of seeded people all over the country into running medical schools. Then in 1910, there was a report by a guy named Abraham Flexner on the state of American medical education, and it was absolutely scandalous, and people were so appalled everywhere in the country. Roughly half the medical schools in the United States closed or merged within the next few years, and largely because of that report, Hopkins model. And since then, American medical education has been very consistent from top to bottom. There are some schools are better than others, but there's no bad school.
So I just had no idea. So you basically have this like long period in which it's kind of a racket. It's basically ascientific medicine men. It's a cartel of folks that train other people who then go out and, peddle whatever crazy, sometimes just totally medieval ascientific, theories of the humors or bloodletting or whatever it is.
Exactly. Right. Well, and then there's part of the American psyche, or so, I don't know if it's a psyche or not, but the anti-intellectualism, the anti-elitism. And of course, part of that was also that medicine couldn't do a lot for you in the early part of the 19th century. They just weren't capable of doing much more than setting a broken limb and maybe some surgeries. So there wasn't much faith in the profession. But by late 19th century, the European doctors were pretty capable. And as I said, to quote William Welch, the results were much better than the system because the system was corrupt. But so many people wanted to be doctors, as I said earlier, they went to Europe for real training.
Right.
And they came back and practiced.
So Welch, basically, I had no idea until I encountered, knew none of this until I read your book, that Welch and Hopkins are sort of the fulcrum point for American medical education. I mean, between the two of them, they sort of transform it from an almost kind of medieval cartel of, healers to a scientific field in which people undertake science. They undertake scientific education. They start doing controlled experiments with patients, right? They start trying treatments. They start doing all the stuff we associate with modern medical schools. And that happens basically right as we head into World War I.
Exactly. And the transformation occurred with almost unbelievable speed in a matter of really a decade and a half. Things changed almost upside down.
So one of the things that obviously the World War One and the flu pandemic are not accidentally correlated. One of the things that you talk about in the book is that war is a petri dish for disease always. That's been the case throughout human history and was certainly the case in a run up to World War One. Why is that? How much more does disease tend to kill than the actual war fighting?
Well, historically, people knew so little about public health. An infection after a wound is without antibiotics is pretty dangerous. Between those two things, pretty much every war disease killed more people than combat. In fact, even the Spanish-American War, cholera killed more American soldiers than combat did. That was largely because of the stupidity of camp commanders who ignored their medical people's advice, who could have saved a lot of lives with very simple public health sanitation measures. But the Surgeon General of the Army, a very interesting guy named William Gorgas, who was one of the heroes in building the Panama Canal by eliminating yellow fever as a threat, he was determined that this would be the first war where disease did not kill more than combat. Turned out to be wrong, but he tried hard.
Obviously, that didn't happen. The pandemic killed more people than in World War One. Is the proximity of all these soldiers next to each other in the trenches, is that the kind of super spreading ignition for the pandemic?
Well, actually, I don't think so. I think it would have happened anyway. And the 1918 pandemic came in waves. The first wave was quite mild, so mild that you could read medical journal articles saying this looks like influenza, it smells like influenza, but you know what? Not enough people are dying, so it's not influenza.
Huh.
And then a few weeks later, the first outbreak of the lethal second wave of the pandemic actually was in Switzerland. And it was so lethal there that an American intelligence report from Geneva said, they say this is influenza, but it's actually the Black Death of the Middle Ages.
Wow.
Of course, it wasn't the Black Death of the Middle Ages. Certainly soldiers suffered more because of their close quarters. But I don't think that was a factor in the evolution of the virus. For example, in New York City in early February 1918, it wasn't noticed at the time. It was only in retrospect, some of the work that came in the early 2000s, a very pronounced spring wave occurred in New York City that had absolutely nothing to do with soldiers. And actually, that predated any outbreak in any of the military camps. So soldiers were dying because they were in close quarters. Anybody who lived in close quarters was more vulnerable. In addition, I'm sure you'd get to this, they were the right age to die. In the 1918 pandemic, targeted young people. The peak age for death was 28.
Wow.
Probably two-thirds of the dead were age 18 to 45, or maybe 50, maybe more than two-thirds if you stretch it to 50. The elderly, people over 65, well over 90% of the excess mortality were under 65 years old, younger than that. So what that means is there had to have been a virus that circulated half a century earlier, very, very similar to the lethal 1918 virus, so similar that it provided a lot of natural protection to the elderly, but so mild that it was basically entirely unnoticed.
Basically, a generational natural vaccine from a similar strain that produced antibodies. It's such a fascinating part of the book that in many ways, there's so many similarities, but in this way, it's inversed because there's this generational cohort that appears to have the antibodies that protects them so that that fatalities are falling squarely on younger people while the old people...
Exactly. And that, of course, is the precise opposite normally of influenza. Normally, as I'm sure you know, and your listeners know, normally influenza kills the elderly and the very young. Now, in 1918, it did kill the very young. I mean, children aged 1 to 4 died at a rate that would be equal to all-cause mortality today for a period of 14 years. So just imagine that. The other thing is that it was incredibly compressed in time. That lethal second wave worldwide covered maybe 15 weeks. And in a given city, it would pass through a city in anywhere from 6 to 10 weeks. So you have the overwhelming majority of the deaths in this really compressed time period. If you're a parent, you can imagine seeing equal to today's all-cause mortality for 14 years compressed into 6 to 10 weeks. You're seeing your kids die. And you yourself, if you're in your 20s and you're the target demographic for that disease, it's pretty scary.
There was the wave in the spring and then the fall, right?
Right.
The more deadly one in the fall. Let's talk about much more. Yeah. So there's the similarities or the things that were remarkable to read your book in this context is there are a ton of similarities. So one of them is, you've got some sort of, it appears, right, some sort of species jump in this novel influenza that people don't have antibodies, or people younger than a certain age have no antibodies for. And so the kind of implacable logic of viral transmission among a naive population, even though the transportation mechanisms at the time are totally different, it's a completely different world. But the simple biological math of spread is basically the same 100 years ago.
Exactly. And for that matter, in the 1600s, influenza pandemic made it from Europe to North America, killed a lot of Native Americans on both continents, not as much as smallpox, but probably close to as much as measles. So you don't need airplanes to spread a pandemic. Obviously, they spread them more quickly. But 1918 got all the way around the world to the most isolated places, jungle villages in Africa, at Labrador, Alaska, Inuit villages, and some of those places, I mean, really high mortality. They had never seen any influenza virus. At least if you were in New York City, you had been exposed to some. So if you had never seen any influenza virus, a totally virgin population, as an epidemiologist would say, you are in trouble. I mean, some of these villages, 100% mortality, not necessarily because the virus killed everybody, but because everybody got sick at the same time. Nobody could even keep someone else hydrated.
Right. The talk a little bit about just what you do a very good job of explaining to the book, just like what a flu virus is. And how it works.
Well, it's an RNA virus, and all RNA viruses mutate rapidly, but not all at the same time. Influenza is one of the fastest mutating. One of the things that's quite unusual about it is that most organisms have their genetic sequence on a continuous strand of, for an advanced organism, DNA, for some viruses, RNA. But influenza, its genome is carried on 8 separate segments of RNA. So if 2 different influenza viruses infect the same cell, they can trade their segments. It's like taking 2 decks of cards and shuffling them together and come out with a new virus. That's what happened in 2009. It's called reassortment. It is, you know, it doesn't have to be lethal. 2009 was no worse, maybe a little better than your average influenza season. Although 2009 actually killed young people, not old people. The peak age for death in 2009 was very close to that it was in 1918.
But this is the H1N1 swine flu.
Yeah. Right, H1N1. But anyway, we're not here to talk about 2009.
Well, so you've got this. It mutates. I mean, right now we seem to be lucky in the sense that the coronavirus is not mutating. And you talk about coronavirus.
It's a lot more stable than influenza.
Right. And you talk about coronaviruses in the book because it's the sort of family of viruses that make the common cold and also produced SARS, which was, had been in the world when you were writing the book. And there are some similarities. I mean, basically the virus is latching on to a part of cell structure, taking over the cell and turning it into a factory for the virus's RNA, essentially, right?
Exactly. That's precisely what happens.
And then one of the things that happens in both influenza and the coronavirus is that there's a huge immunoresponse, and sometimes that immunoresponse itself sends the body into distress.
That's called acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS. And that's one of the factors in why young people were dying in 1918. Their immune systems are stronger than older people. And in many cases, the immune systems has very lethal weapons. It was throwing every weapon it had at the virus. The battlefield was the lung. It was destroying the lung to fight the virus. And people were dying. And same thing today is happening in older people. But their immune systems are of the young people are strong enough to fight off the virus before it becomes that severe.
I want to talk about how the world came to understand what was happening in 1918 and how it fought back once the virus started to make its way through the world. We're going to talk about that right after we take this break.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Today's news requires more facts, more context, and more analysis. The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
So, John Barry, who wrote this great book about the Great Influenza of 1918, so you have this outbreak. It's not dissimilar in structure to other outbreaks that had come before and other outbreaks since, and the outbreak we have now, which is that a virus mutates in a part of the world such that most humans, and in this case the coronavirus, no humans as far as we know have built-in antibodies. You introduce a new virus into a virgin population, you get incredible exponential transmission. That's what we're watching happen now, day by day, with the coronavirus. It's what happened in 1918. At that point, both medicine and public health are fairly nascent American sciences. Talk about the policy response, how policymakers in the U.S. started to understand what was happening in 1918.
Well, that's really where the war came in and became a major factor in what happened. the public health people were pretty good. They had made enormous strides, and we actually had we understood vaccine manufacture, how to scientifically. I mean, some of the scientists I write about, and they're the main characters in the book, were extraordinary. This guy won the Nobel Prize in 1966 for work he did in 1911. He was 55 years ahead of the curve. They won't give you the prize unless you unless they know what your hypothesizing is correct. So it took, he was 55 years ahead of the curve.
Amazing.
And one of the characters, in fact, I dedicated the book to him. He proved polio was a viral disease in 1908 and had a vaccine 100% effective again in monkeys, protecting them against polio 2 years later. So they were good scientists, but they didn't know what was causing influenza. They didn't actually know what a virus was, even though, as I just said, they proved polio was a viral disease. They didn't know if it was an entirely different kind of organism, just a really, really small bacteria. They tried to grow it. You can't grow a virus in a petri dish. You need a living cell. Otherwise, it won't replicate, as you just said. So they couldn't grow the pathogen. They thought the pathogen was a bacteria, which actually still is known as Haemophilus influenza. Influenza is still part of its name. And they were trying to make vaccines against that. They were trying to make vaccines successfully against the pneumococcus, which was caused, a lot of people died of bacterial pneumonia. If you get a pneumonia vaccine today, it's a straight line descendant from what they developed in 1918. But the larger context of the society, I mean, what happens in any disease, any infectious disease, is depending on how the course of that pathogen in an individual's body. What happens in a pandemic is the course of that pathogen through the entire society. And because we were at war, Woodrow Wilson had created an infrastructure dedicated to one thing, winning that war, period. He was obsessed with it. There would be no distractions. One of the things that he did was create what was called the Committee for Public Information, which the architect of that committee wrote, "Truth and falsehood are arbitrary terms. There is nothing in the experience that tells us that one is better than the other." So we had this propaganda arm. In army camps, a popular song was banned, "I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now." Nothing was tolerated that would hurt morale in the views of those in power. So when influenza came along, there was no Tony Fauci. National public health leader said, this is ordinary influenza by another name. It was known as Spanish influenza, even though it didn't start there, but it had that name. And another national public health leader said, yeah, nothing to fear if proper precautions are taken. And these lines were echoed almost everywhere in the United States. This was not ordinary influenza by another name. The symptoms could be horrific, even to the extent that you could bleed not just from your nose and mouth, but from your eyes and ears. That's a pretty horrific symptom, particularly for a layperson. People were turning so dark blue. I quote one doctor writing a colleague, dark blue from lack of oxygen, that this doctor couldn't differentiate between African-American soldiers and white soldiers because their pallor was so similar, which, of course, spread rumors of the Black Death. And that's why earlier I mentioned this U.S. intelligence report said it was the Black Death in Switzerland, not actually influenza. So people are being told by not only national public health leaders, but by their local public health leaders that this is no big deal. And they knew it was a big deal because they knew ordinary influenza didn't kill you in 24 hours, as could happen in this case. And influenza didn't ordinarily cause symptoms that caused an initial misdiagnosis, cholera, as typhoid, as dengue. So they knew they were being lied to. So, I mean, there were two impacts of these lies. The first is people didn't take it seriously initially and therefore were dying. The second is because the lies continued, people lost all trust in what they were being told. They were totally in the dark, and the unknown generates fear. I think ultimately society is based on trust. Without trust in any authority figure, people had to rely on themselves. And in the worst case, society began to fray. And I'll tell you how bad the media was in the sense of minimizing. There was actually a law, the Sedition Act, that could threaten somebody with prosecution for 20 years in jail if they told the truth. So they had reason not to tell the truth. But in Philadelphia, when they finally closed, and Philadelphia is one of the hardest hit cities in the country, if not the world, when they finally closed, you know, schools, bars, and so forth and so on, and at the same time, mass graves were being dug, one of the newspapers said, "These closings are not a public health measure. You have no cause for alarm," unquote.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, how stupid did they think people were? So in Philadelphia, the place began to disintegrate. It was everybody for himself or herself or for their families. When they're calling, when volunteer agencies are calling for volunteers, nobody's showing up. People are literally starving to death because they can't find anyone to bring them food. And that happened not only in Philly, but even in rural communities where you would expect family and community to be everything. The Red Cross reports instances of the same thing. So that will give you some measure of the fear that was out there. And I think that was a direct result of people being lied to. You know, the unknown in your imagination is always going to be more powerful than the reality.
Well, what's so striking about this part of the book is just the resonances. Now, obviously, it's very different in that governments have not continued the denialism all the way through as they did during this, which is just staggering to think of. But it's fascinating that impulse is there. I mean, we know the Chinese government, particularly the local government in Hubei province and in Wuhan, basically tamped down. They lied about it. They said this isn't anything to worry about, that everything's connected to the wet market, that it's pneumonia. We know that the same similar things happened in Iran. We know here in the U.S., we had a month of the U.S. president and people around him saying, talking about what you just said, it's not that different from the flu. The flu kills all these people every year. This is not that big a deal. The market's going to rebound. Like this impulse by policymakers to say, don't worry, it's not that bad. It's so deadly and yet so persistent across time and place.
People don't like to give out bad news. The reality is what Trump did for several months makes no sense, even politically, because he's got to know it's going to come back and bite him. And his own self-interest would have been to be more forthright. But at least in the United States, unlike, say, Brazil right now, you had Tony Fauci, who's always trying to be pretty transparent. You had the CDC saying things that were contradicting the White House. So you did have a disconnect between the White House operation itself and the rest of the administration. And, you know, Azar never made many public statements, but by every indication, he's pretty frustrated. That's HHS secretary I just referred to.
Yeah. Is there a moment or talk about the degree to which this sets in? I mean, you've got mass graves, you've got people starving to death, you've got people dying. I mean, in horrific numbers, right? You've got this happening around the world, and yet it's during the war, and it's not just the U.S. government that's suppressing it. Governments around the world are. Like, it's this quiet death that's creeping across the planet. And unlike today, where the number one news story in every country right now is the virus creeping across the world, the global pandemic, it's almost the opposite then.
It was the opposite, that And here's an example. I didn't write much about Phoenix in the book, but I actually did a lot of research there thinking I might do Philly and Phoenix, but it got too redundant. But the first place the lethal second wave erupted in the United States was Boston. When it was in Boston, you read the Phoenix newspapers, and there's, you know, they're writing about it. When it's in New Orleans, they're writing about it, but less. When it's actually in Phoenix, there is hardly a word in the Phoenix newspapers.
Wow.
It was just something they were going to ignore because they thought it would hurt the war effort, and also possibly because they might have been prosecuted. There was, early in the pandemic, one Wisconsin newspaper did write the truth, and they were threatened with prosecution under the Sedition Act, you know, and which, in fact, to quote it, because this quote I do recall, made it illegal to, quote, utter, write, print, or publish any disloyal, scurrilous, or profane language about the government of the United States, unquote. So you could swear at the government, those MFSOBs, you just broke the law. And they enforced that law. They sent a United States congressman to jail for 15 years under that law. So, as I say, they threatened prosecution of this newspaper, which tried to cover it honestly, although they dropped that as the pandemic continued. But that was the attitude. I don't think ever in American history, and you certainly know probably as much as I do about American history, even in the Red Scare in the 50s, during World War II, the Civil War, certainly not in the Civil War, there was never even this kind of an attempt to control the way people thought.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's crazy being reminded of how totalizing the propaganda operation is at the time. And particularly when the reality of this hits up against it. But there is also the case that, as you just mentioned in passing, you know, when they closed the bars and restaurants in Philly, which is to say there are public health experts at the time who recognize
right.
you have to stop the transmission, and the methods they're using are identical essentially to what we're doing now.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the other key lessons. The first is to tell the truth, because without that, the second one's not going to work. The second one is what we are now calling social distancing. And you have to do it early. You know, after when bird flu erupted, H5N1, U.S. government and governments around the world got deeply involved in pandemic preparedness. And a lot of that, in the United States anyway, and probably elsewhere, was based on analysis of what happened in 1918. So because of my knowledge of that, I was asked to participate in these preparedness planning sessions, at least the conceptualizing, not the fine-tuning with modelers and so forth. And, you know, we analyzed cities, and particularly a guy named Howard Markel at the University of Michigan. We analyzed what cities did in 1918 and found that those cities which intervened early had a much better experience, at the very least in terms of flattening the curve. If you intervene too late, the virus is already widely disseminated in your community, and no intervention is going to have any effect. If the enemy is already inside the home, it doesn't do you any good to lock the door. The difficulty today is getting public support. I think there probably is widespread public support, but a long, long way from unanimous public support for these measures today. But it's hard to get that support when it's not obvious. And the time to take these measures, to impose the restrictions, is before the virus gets widely spread in your community. Once it's already out there, it's pretty much too late, or much, much more difficult to get ahead of it. So those were the two lessons. And you can't get compliance with these social distancing measures unless people believe you. And they're not going to believe you unless you start out telling the truth. I think one of the problems that we're having in the United States today is having spent 2 months minimizing it, both from the White House and from Fox, you have a significant portion of the population that still thinks it's not a big deal and still thinks they don't really need to comply to these measures because they've heard that for 2 months, even though the White House and Fox also have changed their tune significantly on those lines. But it makes compliance that much more harder, which makes it more dangerous, not only for those people who don't comply, but for everybody else in the society.
One of the things I keep thinking about is the memory hole of this experience, which when you read your book, it makes more sense because it was tamped down, because it was kept secret, and because of the trauma of the war. It's such a crazy thing that, you know, everyone knows about World War One. We have an entire literature in the wake of World War One, cultural movements of, you know, novels written about the sort of, you know, the shadow that the charnel house of industrial modernity casts over all of society. We've got The Wasteland, we've got Hemingway, like just this incredible upsurge of cultural reckoning with the grotesquerie that was the First World War. The cultural memory and ripple effects of the pandemic, despite the fact it killed more people, is far fewer. In fact, many people don't learn about it in history. People are sort of discovering it now. And I guess I have a sense from reading your book of why that is, but I'm curious why you think that is.
Well, I thought about that. It's an obvious question. I never really came up with a satisfactory answer. I've got a couple of things I speculate on. Number one, until a couple of decades ago, historians like to write about what people did to people and not what nature did to people. Number two, it was painful and people, you know, tried to bury it. Number three, the whole thing happened so fast. And you're really talking about a period of weeks in any given community. Number four, it was out there. It was part of the psyche. You know, it may have contributed, you know, who knows how much, to the Roaring Twenties, the idea, you know, party on, is who cares about tomorrow?
Right.
You know, Fitzgerald, it may have contributed to what Fitzgerald wrote when he said, "All gods dead, all wars fought, all face and man shaken." When the Nazis walked, you know, took over, marched into Berlin in 1933, Christopher Isherwood was writing Berlin Stories. Isherwood's the guy that Berlin Stories became the movie Cabaret, one of my favorite movies. And if you haven't seen it, something to stream. It's really a great
amazing.
Movie.
Yeah, amazing.
Anyway, Isherwood wrote, when the Nazis entered, quote, "You could feel it like influenza in your bones," unquote. So this is 15 years after the fact, and he expected any of his readers to know exactly what he meant. Mm-hmm. So it was in the back of everyone's mind. But you're right. I mean, there's an incredible lack of literature on it. There's a little bit, Catherine Ann Porter. But John Dos Passos is one of my favorite writers. He got influenza on a troop ship, which is one of the worst places you could possibly get it.
As we're seeing right now, in fact. I mean,
yeah, exactly. And yet he never, I mean, he wrote about two sentences in his entire body of work about it. You know, I can't explain why that is.
What do you think about this moment then in that context? I mean, I'm sitting here, I'm in a closet in a house in which my kids are homeschooling, in which we're, you know, we're around each other all day. Our lives are completely changed. They're totally disrupted. It's the polar opposite of what happened in 1918, where the government said, "Go about your business, it's fine," and people's lives disintegrated or didn't, and then it was gone, and it was horrible trauma and death. We've upended our lives correctly to try to stave off the worst case scenario. And I wonder what you think of how we will make cultural meaning of, I mean, I guess I'm asking you to predict something that you can't, but how we will make meaning of this.
Well, I don't know how we'll make meaning of it. That's too deep for me, maybe, but this is not going to be forgotten. This is going to be written about, analyzed. It's also going to have much more profound effect. You know, 1918, I think, probably did affect people's thinking. I do think it was in the back of their minds. But this is in the front of people's minds for a long term, because it's, you know, whether people using Zoom, that they won't go back to the same number of the meetings, whether it even affects architects or if people don't need office buildings. The best thing about this virus, if you can say there's a good thing, as at least as compared to 1918, it's much less lethal. The worst thing, it lasts a lot. It's going to last a lot longer. The difference is the incubation period. The incubation period for your influenza is 1 to 4 days, and most people get sick after 48 hours. The incubation for this period is 2 to 14 days. Some people are even longer than 14 days. So as that time delay cycles through, instead of passing through a community in as short as 6 weeks and then being gone, having burned through the available fuel, infected everybody who's vulnerable, and, you know, coming back later, but still gone, this thing is just going to drag on, and it's going to have a much longer duration. And, you know, that is going to be a problem with getting people to comply. So you don't sustain that compliance. You know, what we're doing now, we will lose the benefits. You know, we don't have time probably to get into how we get back. There are ways to get back, to get the economy moving, at least in pieces, safely, while also pursuing public health measures that make sense. There are ways to do it, involves testing, antibodies, rapid tests,
right,
people who've had the disease and so forth and so on. I'm sure you've had guests on probably talking about that. But we need a plan. We don't have a plan. The failure of the federal government in this is incomprehensible.
It really is. John Barry is the author of the fantastic book, The Great Influenza. It was published in 2004. But if you're like me and you're sort of craving deeper understanding of the moment we're in, I can't recommend it enough. It's very well written. It's got tons of fascinating insights about a whole different sort of spectrum of issues, the history of medical education and war propaganda. You could also see the article he wrote back on March 17th, The Single Most Important Lesson from the 1918 Influenza. John, great thanks. I really, really really enjoyed this.
Well, so did I. Thank you.
Once again, my great thanks to John Barry. That was a fascinating conversation. I hope you found it as engaging as I did. You can tweet us the hashtag withpod, email withpod@gmail.com. We love getting your feedback, particularly as Tiffany and I sort of work out all the kinks here of this crazy new world of closet podcasting and coronavirus podcasting. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to nbcnews.com/whyisthishappening.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.